Sivakami casts her mind back to the years of her marriage and remembers vividly, still because barely a night has passed in 40 years when she hasn't thought about the acts of love she and her husband performed with each other. She can't help it. Her mind begins to imagine Shantham and the barber's son in these poses, and she shudders, disgusted, but her mind keeps picturing it. She tries to keep the bile down and her mind clear by concentrating on the image she's working in beads, Lord Krishna at Bhutana's poisoned breast. It doesn't work. She runs outside and vomits.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, author Padma Vinswathan reads from her first novel. It's called The Toss of a Lemon, and it follows a Tamil Brahmin family from the days of the Raj to over 100 years later. Imagine a sweeping history of modern India filtered through an epic novel. We meet the heroine, Sivakami, shortly before her marriage at age 10. She's widowed as a teenager. Padma Vinswathan based the character on her grandmother. She defies convention by raising her children more or less alone on a family compound. This reading of The Toss of a Lemon was recorded in October 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Hi, all. How great to be here. Thank you. So, yeah, I'll be reading from my novel, The Toss of a Lemon, this evening. And this novel is based, as some of you might know, on stories that my grandmother told me about her grandmother. At a certain point, about over 10 years ago, I sat with her and asked her to tell me these stories of our family history, stories I'd never heard before. And she went into this story of a woman who, her grandmother, was married as a child, widowed in her teens with two small kids. And as I wrote what became a novel, as I increasingly fictionalized, I left behind the story that my grandmother told me as I was simultaneously learning about the sociopolitical context that she was responding to, that my character Sivakami, because I'll refer to her that way and no longer as my great-great-grandmother, the context she was responding to, even though she knew very little about it as a functional illiterate. She didn't know about those changes, and yet many of the decisions that she was making in her daily life were in response to that. While I was trying to learn about that larger context, I was also imagining myself very intimately into the heads of these people who I'd never known. I mean, the story ends before I was born. So you can imagine my surprise when a couple of years ago, when the book was set to be published and I was in final revisions, I gave the manuscript to my grandma to read and learned that in many ways, although I had departed in plot terms from the story that she had told me, I seem to have hit almost inadvertently on a number of odd emotional truths, and even in some cases on plot points that she had hidden from me, including, for instance, she had not told me about her father's infidelities. That was something I had guessed at, because there were certain things in the story that she told me that didn't really add up any other way, and that became key to my story. I had also, there's a servant character, Muchami, in the book, who is, again, very central to the plot. Sivakami, my main character, is a Brahmin widow in the early 20th century in southeast India, Tamil Nadu, now what's now known as Tamil Nadu. In this time and place, that meant that her head was shaved, she had to wear white, she couldn't basically leave the house. I mean, or she essentially chose not to, because she considered herself to be a bad omen and she didn't want to be seen on the street. And most cruelly, she couldn't touch or be touched from dawn till dusk, even by her own children, with, as you can imagine, huge emotional consequences in her family. Now, her husband hires for her, because he has predicted his own death, he hires for her a servant, Muchami, who becomes, over the course of the story, 50 or 50 plus years, one of her closest friends, her closest confidant. Now, I wondered whether, and this is despite this enormous gulf of gender and caste that separate them, basically because of caste restrictions, he can't enter the house. Because of the restrictions on her, she can't leave the house. And yet, they collude and they collaborate in raising this family. And I wondered whether I would be challenged on this point. When my grandma read the book, she told me something that she'd never told me before, that fortunately I was still in revisions and I could include, which was that when the real Muchami died, my great-great-grandmother took a ritual bath for him, which is something that a Brahmin only does for a close relative, never for a mere servant. So that for me was one of the most touching examples of a way in which I had somehow, by trying so hard to enter this story, hit on some things that I might not have learned if I had simply stuck to my research. Anyway, I'm going to read you a little excerpt, a story called The Barber Lover. At this point, Sivakami has been a widow for about 40 years. And as you know, Machami is her servant, Vairam is her son, and Minister and Murthy are her servants. And I think that's all you need to know to understand this. The story takes place in the 40s, this little bit does. Oh, and the other thing that might help you to know is that in the story, Machami is gay. It's not explicitly stated, but it's pretty obvious. Some unwelcome but not unexpected information reaches Machami via his regular channels. He had, a week or 10 days earlier, put a word out requesting this information after having seen something that didn't look quite right. He doesn't go out every night as he did when he was younger, but does still make his way through the woods and fields twice or three times a week in search of other men, like him, who need physical satisfactions they cannot give or receive in their marriages. It happens that he sees things on these journeys. Some things he understands immediately, some he must work to interpret. The only people abroad at night are those, like Machami, it could be argued, who have no choice. One of those who must be out is the barber who clips the heads of Brahmin widows, a work of shame and sorrow done in the dark hour favored by demons. Sivakami has her head shaved monthly, usually by the same barber who sheared her curls in the days of her widow-making and left her light-headed under the moonlight. Now, occasionally, it is his second son who comes. The first son used to come, until his family decided he, meaning all of them, would be better off if he used his skill with a blade to get latex out of trees and Malayan plantations. So it happened one night that Machami was returning home and saw the barber's second son entering the rear courtyard of a Brahmin quarter widow. He didn't think it strange until, some 10 days later, he saw the same thing again. It was then that he mentioned it to some cohorts, who have now confirmed for him that the barber's second son, Karupan, has been seen coming and going from the house of the widow Shantham 4 or 5 nights each week. No one's hair grows that fast. Machami is outraged. He stalks home as though burning the fields in his wake, like Hanuman setting Lanka alight with his tail. He knows he must decide what best to do with this information, and that it might be his obligation to go to Vairam, who, as his employer and the master of a house on a Brahmin quarter, is most entitled to know and take action. But Machami is not convinced that Vairam will do what must be done. He has never shown caste loyalty. If anything, he acts as though it would please him to see the entire Brahmin quarter in ruin. And if he tells Vairam, and Vairam does nothing, it will be much, much more difficult to redress this ill. He decides to call a conference. He invites Minister and Murthy to come to Sivakami's house after tiffin. He tells Vairam not to go play tennis. He tells Sivakami only that the others will be coming, not why. He is trembling at the impropriety of it. This is the sort of thing about which he could gossip to Sivakami were it to have happened several villages away, but so close to home, to the home whose honor it is his dearest duty to uphold. Now Machami, standing in the door to the garden, tells them what he knows. Murthy begins immediately to splutter and shake. Minister looks circumspect and deeply troubled. How it came about, they wonder, but have no idea. Maybe Karupan forced her the first time and has been blackmailing her. Vairam looks exasperated. What concern is this of mine? He asks Machami, and then looks at the others to see if they can answer. Let her bring shame on her own head and her house. No, son. Minister cradles his forehead in his forefinger and thumb. It looks as if someone gave him a gun and he can't decide how to use it. He is the criminal in this situation. A woman's virtue is that of her family, and he has destroyed it, whether or not she chooses each night to open her door. I can't even understand. How can you both be still sitting and talking? Murthy has leapt from his chair. Open her door. I'll open his head. That's what. He is running for the door now, his hands over his ears. Oh, my ears are poisoned by what I've heard today. He stumbles in an attempt to mount the 2 or 3 steps to his own veranda and succumbs to an attack of asthma, whereupon a few passers-by stop to ask what is wrong. He tells them. That night, Shantham's nearest neighbor's servants are posted in the brush beyond her courtyard gate. The unlucky lover arrives. He pushes open the door, enters, closes it behind him. Each of the servants slips from his hiding place. Each goes to the door of the house he serves and tells his employer that the barber is inside. Each goes to the next house and tells the master of that house. Moments pass, and from each house emerges its master. Each master carries a big stick. What is the barber's second son thinking? He must be about 17, she about twice his age, plump and fair, while he is dark as rosewood. Sivakami thinks of them as she does her beating, working fast, very fast. She hears one of the servants knock on their door to inform Vairam that the moment has come for action. Muchami, who is spending the night in the courtyard, tells him Vairam will not come because Vairam has said he will have nothing to do with this nonsense, that mobs always chase phantoms, that he has work in the morning, unlike these professional moralists in search of a night's entertainment. There are more than enough hands, anyway, more than 15 pairs, all holding sticks, heading for the house. Did he force her? Sivakami wonders. But why didn't she just bar the door and not permit him to come again? Could he really have blackmailed her? She would have been defiled and disgraced, but better than going through it night after night, no? Unless she really did choose this. Sivakami can barely bring herself to think it. A barber, one of the worst classes of untouchables. A Brahmin woman choosing to be with a barber. Sivakami casts her mind back to the years of her marriage and remembers vividly, still, because barely a night has passed in 40 years when she hasn't thought about the acts of love she and her husband performed with each other. She can't help it. Her mind begins to imagine Shantham and the barber's son in these poses, and she shudders, disgusted, but her mind keeps picturing it. She tries to keep the bile down and her mind clear by concentrating on the image she's working in beads, Lord Krishna at Bhutana's poisoned breast. It doesn't work. She runs outside and vomits. Kadrupan has closed the door but not drawn the heavy bolt. He never does. Why should he? Shantham is waiting for him on the wooden bench at the back of the house where she is made to sleep. She hates sleeping there, but each of the bedrooms is now taken up with one of her late husband's brothers. Each of them is married now, and so they need private rooms. She could sleep in a corner of the main hall with the children, but it's her mother-in-law's prerogative, and she wants Shantham to sleep outside. Shantham makes up for it in small cruelties toward her nephews and nieces, and even sometimes toward her own children. She is sitting, waiting for him on the bench. He crosses to her on silent feet. Her sari has already slipped from her head, and now he unwinds it from her shoulders and buries his face in the soft flesh between her collarbone and breast, stroking his lips and eyelids across the pillow of silky, fragrant skin. She is so unlike the women of his class. Not that he has had one yet, but he can tell. They stand and walk past them, the cowshed into the garden, her sari beginning already to unwrap. They pull it after themselves and spread it on the garden floor. And when the enraged men burst into the courtyard and run from there into the garden, this is what they see. The widow trying to wrap herself back into the white sari that has been serving as her illicit conjugal bed, and the glistening form of the barber's second son reaching the top of the garden wall and jumping down off it. By now, Shantham's mother-in-law and other family members who had not been informed about the raid have flung open numerous internal doors. Some of the men run through the house to the front and start shouting for those doors to be unlocked, while others have already run back out and through the neighbors' houses onto the Brahmin Quarter street to see which way the scoundrel is going. Every woman on the street, except Sivakami, is witness to the flight of the naked and terrified boy who streaks straight up the Brahmin Quarter, whistled along by the wind of the matron's gasps. The men give chase. They chase him far through bramble and brooks. He is much faster than they, but two send their servants on bicycles to cut him off. He is caught. These weak, pulpy Brahmins, worked up by the chase, beat Kadrupan very badly. Muchami helps in the chase, but participates only a little in the beating. Shantham is also chastised and lightly beaten by her mother-in-law in front of her children and all her brothers and sisters-in-law. These are the events of that night. Sivakami hears the men return and go to their homes. Muchami comes back too and tells her what happened. Then he lies down in the courtyard to sleep. She closes the kitchen doors, goes into the pantry and closes those doors too. She lies where she normally lies. She's calmer, but can feel the horrible images trying to reform in her mind's eye. She tries to banish them again in images of her husband, his skin sliding against hers. The smoothness of his back where she gripped it, her fingertips notching his spine, slip in with distressing ease to replace those of the barber's son, who is just a few years younger than Hanumaratnam was when he died. Sivakami doesn't permit herself to move. She lies as every night on her side, on the cool floor of the pantry, her neck on a wooden rest, but shifts her legs minutely against that delicious discomfort that now can never be eased. She had almost managed to forget that gnaw and tickle, brushed it away with busyness and prayer. The advance of age was a relief. In the last 10 years, the craving has begun to diminish. Now her chest feels thick with anger at Shantham for having reminded her. Shantham has been a widow for less than 10 years. Less than 10 years, feeling no touch save that of her children, And even that only after sunset, and Shantham's not even permitted to sleep with them. Sivakami recalls that for her first years of widowhood, when she slept curled around Vairam, the warm pressure of his milk-smelling, dream-twitching little boy body anchoring her to her own body, which seemed, in daylight, not to exist at all. Sivakami wraps her arms around herself, biting her lip. She knows what Shantham has endured, but it is their lot to endure. If not, why else does Sivakami live as she does? What appeal is there in a topsy-turvy world? And what place does a widow have, if not this one? At first light, the next morning, a bullock solemnly pulls a cart down the Brahmin quarter from Shantham's house toward Kulithale. On the cart are two men and a big load of hay from which they're creating a wake, systematically depositing large handfuls behind them on the path and roadway. When this is done, a priest from the Brahmin quarter temple drops three lumps of burning camphor at the edge of the straw carpet, which begins where Kadupan landed after vaulting Shantham's wall. Three palms of flame grow fingers, join hands, and run up the Brahmin quarter. Where the fire hits a pocket of damp, it pops and hisses, much like the good Brahmin folk of the village, waiting for the street to be purified so they can meet and rehash the night's events. When the veil of smoke lifts, the carpet of straw has magically changed into one of ash with little straw bits here and there, and the Brahmin quarter, too, has been magically restored to its former untouchability, which the untouchable robbed by his touch. Shantham disappears the next day, taking with her her jewels, those that should have been her daughter's, and six silk saris belonging to her sisters-in-law. She's never seen in Shorapati again. Kadupan, the barber's second son, needs surgery and is taken to the French Mission Hospital to have it done, but by then he's been bleeding internally for 10 or 12 hours, and so it's too late, and he dies. At the beginning of the following year, the company employing Kadupan's older brother fails. It's a bad time for rubber, and for companies generally. He's sent home on a ship that gets caught in a typhoon and founders on some rocks. If there are survivors, he's not among them. His parents have now lost both of their sons. They never have grandchildren. Their older son's widow, as is not uncommon in their community, remarries. The elder barber goes back to shaving the heads of all his customers. Perhaps he still says, "I'm sorry," as he did to Sivakami before shaving a Brahmin widow's head for the first time. Perhaps not. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, yeah, so there have been attempts by the government in India through the years to, through legislation, through law, to outlaw the caste system. Have they been effective? Are they more effective? Or is the government irrelevant to the social fabric?
As far as I know, most caste practices are illegal, except perhaps the way that you eat your dinner in your home or the things that you do to worship, and yet they persist. Whether that means that government is irrelevant, I wouldn't say so. I mean, even here, progress is always a matter of, you know, some group pushing, some group supporting, some group following along reluctantly. And I think change there has been, a similar process. Many things have changed, but many things have just transmuted and are expressed in different forms. So, I mean, caste very much persists in one form or another.
So, Padma, I'd like you to talk about your character Thangam, or Thangam, uh-huh. How do you say it?
Thangam.
Thangam. Can you talk about how you came up with the character who sheds gold?
Okay.
And what that's all about? When I read that, I was like, God, that's so interesting, but I want to know more.
So the question is about a character in the book, Sivakami's daughter, whose name is Thangam. Thangam literally means gold in Tamil. Hers is the second name, that the only other name that's taken directly out of my family history. One-to-one correspondence. My great-grandmother's name was Thangam. It's also an endearment. I mean, my grandmother calls us Thangam, calls my children that. So I had this little girl who was born, and perhaps in a fit of inspiration of some kind, she's extremely heavy, and her eyes are gold, and she's born into a time in my book when people took much that we would call otherworldly for granted. I mean, there are some things in my book, like the witch who lives next door to Sivakami, and she is just, my great-great-grandmother lived next to a witch, and, you know, she cast spells on people, and et cetera, et cetera. And so that was something that I didn't have to fictionalize. And there are various other elements like that. My great-great-grandfather really did predict his own death. So those were elements that might appear to be magical realist, but were for, you know, the people in that time and place just realist. Just to summarize for people who haven't read the book, her name means gold, and she literally in some way embodies gold. She's precious. She's magnetic in a way that gold really isn't. But eventually her heart starts to break, and she, for reasons you'll find out if you read the book, and she starts to shed a gold dust that she trails after her in the house, and people start to gather it up and use it as a kind of holy ash, which is a sort of an echo of her father's profession, because he was a healer, and he would, like various of my uncles, sit down on his veranda and give advice to people, and often the advice would take the form of a pinch of holy ash in a little paper packet, and they would say, you know, put a pinch of this on your tongue or rub it on your baby's tummy, and people start to use Thungam's gold like that too. And Sivakami, in her own way, those plackets that she's beading, people take them, and they're charms for women in childbirth. So all of Hanumaratnam, the father, Sivakami, the mother, and Thangam have advertently or inadvertently healing powers, which Vairam, the son, doesn't have. So you can see that in one way or another, and people have asked me, are many of your choices deliberate? And I feel like many choices like that are a combination of sort of intuition and inspiration, along with trying to enter the logic of the story, what makes sense within the story. And so for Thangam, for her personality, her physicality, and her role in the family, it seemed to make sense that that would happen to her. I knew also that eventually her eyes would turn blue from this heartbreak, and it just seemed natural then that that would be because her gold had drained from her. She was more than anybody sort of based on a truth that my grandmother felt about her own mother, and I was unable in a way to transcend that. But so many of the other characters are, in spite of themselves, fighting their fate that I felt like I wanted to see to an extent. I eventually gave into it in a way that I let her give into it.
How did the father predict his own death, and why do you call it Toss of a Lemon?
Okay, those are related title questions. Hanumaratnam, the father, his horoscope contains a shadow that suggests that he will die young. This is the horoscope that he was born with. And he probably reread it for himself because he's a renowned astrologer. What he's hoping, though, is that the birth of a son will avert this disaster. He marries, and their first child, though, is a girl. And with every child who's born, you need a horoscope calculated, which determines primarily the search for a marriage partner, but also might determine some other things in their life. So because he's such a good astrologer, he wants to calculate his own children's horoscopes. But he needs to know the exact moment of the birth time in order to do so. And he's not allowed in the birthing chamber. You know, my husband was present when our kids were born, and he can't be present when his kids were born. So he gives the midwife a lemon. And he's pacing in the garden just outside the birthing chamber, and he tells the midwife, toss this lemon out the window to me in the garden the moment the child's head appears. So the first baby is a girl, Thangam, baby crowns, the midwife tosses the lemon, he gets a birth time, but she's a girl. And although her horoscope is very significant in the story, it doesn't affect his. It doesn't affect the shadow of death in his own horoscope and his own fate. The second baby is a boy, but he's also a breach birth. So the midwife, she sees a bum, she doesn't know what to do, and then the baby's born, he hears the crying, and he goes, toss the lemon, and she tosses the lemon out the window, but the time is fudged. He calculates the little boy's horoscope. Contrary to his hopes, the little boy's horoscope confirms his father's death. But we're never really certain whether the horoscope is correct. And pretty much, I mean, those two tossed lemons more or less determine the course of the story. That all happens early on. That's like the first 30 pages. No spoilers.
Since the Tamil language was such an important part of the anti-caste movement and the independence movement, how did you cope with that with writing an English language novel?
Oof. And especially because my Tamil is so bad. It's really terrible. Regardless, I knew that this was going to be an English language novel, and it figures. The fact that this is an English language novel eventually is discussed in the book. So I had to cope with it, I guess, in the same way that I'm translating everything. I mean, all of the conversations take place in Tamil, not just the ones, you know, centering on the, you know, the Dravidian nationalist movement. So I didn't really try to give the a sense of pure Tamil except, you know, once or twice, and I don't even think I particularly changed the diction to do so. It was really just all about context and description. So it was hard. I mean, I did feel like throughout the novel was an act of translation, not just from one language to another, but one time into another and one place into another. And so all of those were sort of enormous spans to be bridged.
I'm wondering, when you were writing a story that was based on family myths and family stories, were there any hard choices that you had to make about things that you really wanted to write about, things that people felt was very private to the family, or other kinds of emotional conflicts between, like, the relationships that you have with people you love and what you wanted to write about?
I really felt that I had to separate myself from those anxieties to be able to write the book. So I let my mother have all of those anxieties instead. And she was terrified for the whole, like, 10 years that I was writing this. The relatives are going to come down on her in hordes for having dishonored our family. But I just felt like there was no way for me to write the novel that I wanted to write if I was going to be concerned about that. What I did do, though, you know, I interviewed my grandma. And I transcribed our conversations, and I said that those transcripts, her words, were under lock and key for 20 years. I wouldn't show them to anybody because of the things that she told me. She confided in me not only incidents, but her opinions of those incidents and her opinions of the people involved. And so I wouldn't show them to anybody. But she knew that I was using them as my raw material for the book. But I just tried to make it clear to people that it's fiction. But ultimately, I mean, she read the book. My mother read the book. The one thing my mom was worried about, actually, was the sex scene. She wasn't worried about any of the family secrets. She was worried about Janaki, who's the character very loosely based on my grandma, has a wedding night where she has sex, and I, you know, describe it. And my grandma and my mother was just like, please, you know, could you please just cut that one scene? Like, do you really, it'll spoil all of grandma's pleasure in the book if, you know, she, and I was like, I just can't do that, Mom. I just can't do that. And so I gave my grandma, I was staying with my folks, and my grandma was staying there, and I gave her the manuscript, and I happened to walk in on her as she was reading that scene. And I asked her, you know, so what part are you on, Grandma? And she goes, a very, very shy part. and that was it. I mean, she didn't criticize me for having included that, nor did she criticize me for having included, for instance, you know, her father's infidelities. Many of the secrets were, in a way, open secrets, I think. And then other family members have read it since then, where I was also more concerned, not just about our family, but about how people would take my sort of message of caste criticism in a way. Like, I wondered if some of my relatives were hoping that I was going to, you know, raise the Brahmin shield and, you know, stand up for our, you know, the rising of our caste again and all of this. And people have not been too bothered, by the way. I've handled it mostly, I think, because I've done it compassionately. I mean, even though Sivakami is, to be frank, a bigot, many of my characters behave in a way that's, you know, violent and sometimes reprehensible. But they are very closely based on people like my aunts and uncles who hold views that I disagree with, and they know this because I've argued with them my whole life, and I also love them very dearly and honor them for their integrity. And I think that I hope that I've treated all of my characters with compassion, and I'm, you know, trying to bring readers inside of this world to say that, you know, even though I think it's better that the caste system be, and, you know, however, even though it's impossible, be dismantled, still there was a beauty to the way that those people lived, and they felt it. So,
hi, I have a question that's in many ways, I guess, a follow-up to what she was just asking, kind of an underlying issue that you've been addressing. I'm a historian, and I love reading novels, but I'm interested in how you came to make the choice of making this fiction rather than, I don't know, a memoir or something like that. And I suppose, you know, you could just sort of answer, well, I'm a, you know, you're a novelist, that's, you like writing that way. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the whole sort of what you think is at stake in terms of your own thought process about these things, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a terrible historian. I'm not just an okay novelist. I'm a really, like, I'm very bad at many things that I thought, at least when I started, historians need to be good at, such as dates, times, places, that kind of thing, right? I know. In the course of working on it, though, and talking with historians, I mean, I've come to understand more about the, you know, the process of historical investigation, and I think perhaps become a better historian in the process. But it was mostly, yeah, about my skill set. Try to write a nonfiction book about the people that I wanted to write, which included not only people in my family, but people like Muchami, who didn't really exist on paper, in a sense. And, you know, what was I going to do? Try to interview his descendants about how he lived. I really had to do it based on observation, based on what I had seen, of how, for instance, the servants in my mother's house lived, you know, by the time I was old enough to sort of understand how they lived and et cetera. I mean, they were no longer working in the houses. We were living in Canada, but I would go back with them to their villages. When I was tiny, you know, the servant who was still working in my grandma's house looked after us. And it was, you know, there's as much sort of emotional detail that is incidental as anything that I would be able to back up. In a way, I had to be able to do this really speculatively and not, I don't know, perhaps open myself to questions about accuracy.
It's funny because to think of it from the other perspective, it's scary to imagine making stuff up that would be plausible. So mm-hmm. if you take, I mean, it's interesting the way you're describing the history writing part as something that opens you up to criticism, because if you look at it from the perspective of a right. historian, it's the other thing that can right. sound terrifying.
Yeah, it just depends which risks you're willing to take, right? I mean, there's one incident. There's only one thing that I know that I deliberately moved in time, and nobody's picked up on it yet. So it's like one of the very few sort of public documents that was not published at the time when I have it in there, but nobody's noticed. One of my uncles said, okay, you know, he gave me lots of thumbs up and then a couple of what he called brickbats. And the brickbats that he gave me were errors. So I had, in one point, I had turned the banana leaf around that people used to eat on. I hadn't got it the right way, so I corrected that. But he also told me that, well, widows are not allowed to go to the cremation ground. You can't have Sivakami going to the cremation ground because, see, there's this poem written by this poet in which he describes how widows are not allowed to go to the cremation ground. That's only true in his district. In our district, you know, 50 miles away, they were. And so this is, I mean, I think one thing that I can do in fiction is, you know, I've put in these things that are, you know, they are historically accurate, but I suppose I don't need to explain the whys and hows, but, you know, not everybody thinks that they're right anyway. I'm not sure if I've answered your question. Yeah.
This is my introduction, really, to Indian anything. Huh. So it's kind of the best way for me to, the easiest way for me to learn history. But I'm wondering about the history that I'm learning. For example, your grandmother had a servant who still stayed with her. Now, is that servant of a different caste?
Oh, yeah.
What caste?
He would have been from one of the agricultural castes. I don't name it in the book, but he would have been from an agricultural caste. I mean, there was a Brahmin exodus in the 50s and 60s as government policies were instituted to enable other castes to enter government service and to enter universities. Brahmins sort of felt forced out of their positions of historical privilege, but they had the chops, they had the qualifications to gain places in universities here. And so that's how many people, including, you know, people including my dad, came to North America. The servants didn't come.
That's what I was also going to ask you, is I'm assuming that eventually, after there are several more generations, there won't be the close connection with India, there won't be relatives who still live there to whom you visit, and there won't be so intimate at all a knowledge of not only the caste system, but also a following of a lot of these same traditions.
Yeah, it's already very much true. I mean, even people in a generation just slightly younger than my parents have said, oh, I remember this. You know, you've captured these things that I remember from visiting my grandma when I was young. My aunt said this, and she's like 15 years younger than my parents, but has lived in Canada since her 20s, so 25 years now. Part of what I wanted to do with this was to document a vanishing world. It's odd now. I mean, I'm married to somebody who's not from India, and I haven't been back to India since our kids were born. My parents live with us, though, during the academic year to look after our kids, and so my kids' like only real connection to India at this point is through my parents. But now with the, you know, the rise of India, the new superpower, many of my cousins who had moved here 10 years ago to take jobs with American companies are now moving back. I now have more cousins in India than I did 10 years ago, almost as many as I had 20 years ago. So, you know, it seems that increasingly now perhaps we do have excuses for me to be able to take my kids back, but it's a different India that they'll get to know from the one that I knew, you know, 30 years ago.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Wonderful.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.